Okay. We're going to go on to case number 3, which is 103898, and it's Weitzenkamp versus Unum Life Insurance. Good morning, Mr. Olson.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Oh, you've been here before.
I saw someone else operating that. Comes in handy. Good morning. I am Al Olson, and I'm representing the plaintiff today. This is a long-term disability claim under an ERISA policy. The disability is fibromyalgia. The contested policy provision is a self-reported symptoms clause that kicks in after the first 24 months of benefits. That clause is in the policy, but it is not in the summary plan document. Ordinarily, in this case, the standard of review over the plan administrator's decision would be arbitrary and capricious. However, in this case, it should be a de novo standard due to two very serious substantive procedural errors by this administrator. The first error by the administrator was the violation of the claimant's privacy when he specifically, two times in writing, disclosed the claimant's private medical information to her employer. This was not merely a technical violation like in the Keystone case. It was not merely a minor, insignificant error like in the Kreutzer case. This was a significant error that's forbidden not only by state and federal law, but Unum also has a written policy that assures the privacy and confidentiality of the claimant, and also further affirmative assurances by Unum in the authorization form signed by Ms. Weitzenkamp that said that her privacy would be protected and her private medical records would not be disclosed. There's case law that when there is a serious procedural violation, the appropriate standard of review should be more scrutiny than arbitrary and capricious and a de novo standard.
Why does that make sense for this kind of procedural error? It really has nothing to do with eligibility or with the review process.
It makes sense, Your Honor, in that those violations of her rights under the policy by the administrator should not be given deference. There are other substantive violations as well that are procedural that go to the issue more specifically of the claimant's disability.
I understand that, but you're arguing that in essence, if under a plan that provides the discretionary authority and arbitrary and capricious review, this violation of privacy rights requires that we turn the standard of review upside down. And I'm just having trouble with the connection. Does your client have any rights under common law for that violation?
I don't know if she has any rights under common law. The only point in this argument is that the court will normally back off and give discretion where that's reserved in the plan and give deference to that administrator with the expectation that that administrator follows his fiduciary duty and complies with the rules. But that deference should not be provided in the instance where that administrator violates that trust. And that trust was clearly given in writing by Weitzenkamp to Unum to protect her privacy interests. There were two additional problems with procedure in that Unum hid Dr. Bress's control point exam opinion from Ms. Weitzenkamp. Dr. Bress reviewed the documents. He didn't examine the claimant. and determine that the reliability and the specificity of the tender point exam that her treating physician, Dr. Partain, performed could have been addressed through a control point exam. Unum copied and pasted his entire opinion into its letter denying the benefits, but extracted from it the two references made by Dr. Bress that control point exam would have allowed him to determine whether her testing was reliable. And that goes directly to the issue of whether a test or a clinical exam that's standardly accepted in medicine can be verifiable. That's the definition under the policy. And had we known that that's what Dr. Bress said he needed, we certainly, there's no reason why Ms. Weitzenkamp would not have undergone such a test.
She never underwent that test.
Not the control point test.
The point trigger test, is that what you're talking about?
No, and there's apparently a distinction because Dr. Bress refers to the trigger point or pressure point test that was done by Partain, her treating doctor, on Ms. Weitzenkamp over a period of time, 2.5 years.
But isn't...
And distinguishes it from the control point test.
Isn't the company conceding that she has this diagnosis?
Yeah. Well, this goes beyond the diagnosis, though. And it's not just talking about the diagnosis. He's talking, to use his language, the reliability and specificity of the test that she did have. If she underwent this second type of test, a different type of test, a control point test, not a trigger point test, then it could have been determined whether her reactions were reliable. And that is specifically what their definition is that she would need, something verifiable.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm thinking about the Hawkins case and, you know, where we noted that the symptoms of chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia, whatever, are entirely subjective, and that it's difficult to determine the severity of the condition because it is. Isn't that the type of disability that the self-reporting clause was designed to address, to avoid the prospect of unlimited claims that are based on symptoms that really are very difficult to objectively challenge?
Your Honor, there's been an evolution in the law as well as in medicine, and the physicians continue to struggle with the diagnosis and the treatment of the condition. That is true. However, as this court stated in Sarche versus Chater, when the 18 fixed locations on the body are pressed firmly, it will cause a patient to flinch. That's a physiological reaction to a test. It is not a something that is merely communicated by the patient.
You know, I find that so interesting because people can know when to flinch.
Well, there's also, Your Honor, built-in false positives where the doctors know that if the patient is flinching on a non-pressure point, that indicates a false positive and that person's exaggerating or faking.
Isn't that what a control point test is?
Yeah.
In essence, checkpoints that are not part of the 18?
Your Honor, it wasn't explained. I don't know exactly what it is, and I've tried to find out. All we're left with is the definition by Dr. Bress, the reviewing doctor, that it would provide reliability and specificity on that testing and therefore verify it. The medical treatises also describe physiological changes through the testing. It's not merely self-reported symptoms. There's change in skin texture. There's change in resting muscle tension. Subcutaneous tissue texture will change. Muscle twitch. Again, maybe someone's capable of twitching their muscles like they are capable of flinching. But these are things that a doctor will discern over years of treatment and hands-on care and review with his personal patient. Also, there's a nodular texture similar to a pencil eraser. I'd find that hard to believe that somebody could create that on command. In fact, in this case, Dr. Partain, the treating doctor, injected each tender fibrocystic nodule with an evolving regimen of medications. Dr. Partain also found neurological evidence of Weitzenkamp sensitivity to temperature and concluded district court found objective findings that, according to Dr. Partain, the claimant could not sit or stand more than 20 to 30 minutes. She could not walk more than one block. She would be absent from work at least or approximately 4 days per month, and she was in constant pain. In the diagram, he filled out all the spaces on the form and showed in the diagram she was in constant pain throughout her body. Physical evidence such as this satisfies the policy's intent to prevent people from submitting fake disability claims. The Welch decision out of the Tenth Circuit addressed this identical unum claim provision.
No, it's not identical. In Welch, the record contained statements from an outside doctor hired by Unum noting that he could objectify the level of the disability by having a trained physical therapist conduct that activities exam, and that such a exam was fairly standard. Now, Unum had never requested that exam.
Right.
And therefore ignored possible objective evidence to establish the symptoms.
And did
so
not
the court
ask,
found, you know, that it was an arbitrary decision. But what's the evidence in this record that doctors believed there was an objective way to determine the severity of her symptoms and Unum ignored it?
Well, Dr. Bress said this control point exam would, twice in his opinion, stated that it would provide the reliability and specificity necessary to authenticate what she was complaining about. That's all we're left with. What's more egregious...
Forgive me, but it seems to me that what the Welsh court held was that the self-reported symptoms clause is to be applied not to the diagnosis of the underlying disease itself, but to the disability that's caused by the disease.
Well, I'd agree that the manifestations, but the problem with this case as well as in Welch is that Unum is only looking at half of the definition. Just because it's a self-reported symptom does not...
That's consistent with how it's being interpreted in this case.
Well, my point is that when they look at half the definition, if it's a self-reported symptom, that alone does not knock the claimant out of eligibility for benefits if the self-reported symptom can be verified through other tests. They said such a test didn't exist. They affirmatively stated that in the Welch case, they merely omitted it and didn't say anything about it. It's the same situation here. Had Unum notified Weitzenkamp of an available test, she certainly would have undergone that. There's also an estoppel issue in this case.
Before you get on to that, could you talk briefly about the Eighth Circuit's decision in Chronister? It seems to me that the district judge was, in essence, inviting us to create a circuit split here in the interpretation of this Unum clause.
And
the Eighth Circuit held in that case that this clause did not apply to fibromyalgia where there were positive trigger point findings.
Your Honor, we are not arguing that the merely need to satisfy objective evidence of the diagnosis. We understand that we need to further substantiate objectivity as to her suffering, her symptoms. Fibromyalgia is, by definition, pain. It's a pain syndrome. That's how they define it.
Why doesn't the Eighth Circuit tell us you win?
My main concern is with the Seventh Circuit at this point. The Eighth Circuit,
I understand
if they've distinguished it like Hawkins to say that there is no objective test beyond the diagnosis, or that if you can't show that, you're off the hook, we're not claiming that. We're saying that her condition is verifiable through 2.5 years of treatment by her doctor and hands-on care.
Her symptoms or her manifestation of
manifestations are verified. They're authenticated. That addresses the concern where somebody's faking a condition and they're trying to get benefits off of a plan under fraud. That's not what happened here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Do you want to put that up? Is that what you want?
I'm glad that Mr. Olson ate his vegetables, I think. I think this will work okay. May it please the court, and good morning, Your Honors. Maybe to just jump right into Judge Hamilton's question, what does Chronister do in this case? I really think, Judge, and it's Unum's position that Chronister got it wrong. Chronister was looking really at the diagnosis, not the manifestation of
the
condition.
So you think we should split and invite the Supreme Court to resolve an issue that you all could have fixed 5 years ago by rewriting the clause?
Possibly, although it takes a while to get caught up on these policies. But I don't believe, I believe the reasoning is distinguishable. Chronister didn't look at the manifestation issue. Chronister leveraged Hawkins versus First Union, which was a diagnosis case.
Let's distinguish between two different things. You can attack the reasoning of Chronister. Would you agree that its holding is directly contrary to your position?
Yes.
Okay. So we would have to create a circuit split to rule in your favor.
I would leave it to the judges to define what a circuit...
Tell me why it's not.
If you look at how Chronister reached its decision, and again, it's really at the tail end of that decision, and it references
it's the pivotal issue, right?
It is.
It's the
but
issue on which you lost.
Ultimately, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what happened, my point on it, Your Honor, is the Eighth Circuit leveraged the Hawkins v. First Union decision, which, is, as Your Honor described, talks about the difficulty in diagnosing. And I think the Chronister Court just got off on the wrong foot in focusing again on whether the diagnosis was verifiable. I mean, Unum's not disputing here that the diagnosis is verifiable. For Chronister to line up with this case, the issue would have to focus on the manifestation of that diagnosed condition. And they don't address that issue. And that's, I guess, the only way you can distinguish, or Unum can distinguish Chronister.
It's not a distinction. It's an argument why it's wrong.
Correct.
And that's what I'm trying to understand. Can you distinguish it as opposed to just argue that it's wrong?
I don't believe we can factually distinguish it, Your Honor, that the court was wrong in its decision, and I believe a reflection on that is how it cited the Hawkins v. First Union decision, and there's very little analysis as well.
Does the provision effectively limit coverage to 24 months for all diseases for which the disabling symptoms are pain, because pain is always subjective?
Yes, it does. I mean, it doesn't preclude coverage. It just limits coverage to 24 months when the manifestations of the condition are self-reported, and then there are examples, pain, fatigue, I think dizziness is in there.
So if the degree of pain is consistent with the pain that would be expected from the diagnosed disease, why should that be considered a disability that's primarily based on self-reported symptoms? Let's say someone had a severe spinal condition that would be expected to cause significant pain. Would that 24-month limit apply regardless because there would be no objective means to determine how much pain the person was in, and therefore the disability would primarily be based on that individual's self-reports of pain?
Yes. If, regardless of the etiology of the pain, under this particular provision, the claimant is limited to 24 months of benefits. If it's based primarily on pain or some other subjective self-reported symptom. Now, there's not a lot of jurisprudence on these provisions. I mean, the employer, pick and chose what provisions it wanted in this policy. And under ERISA, and I think this court stated in a case that we cited in our brief, Congress didn't mandate a level of coverage in welfare benefit plans, and this court wasn't going to set a level of coverage either. Ms. Weitzenkamp's employer could have requested this provision be gone, or could have made it 5 years or 6 years, or could have made it 12 months. I mean, I've seen some policies where there's a 12-month provision in it. This is something that was bargained for between Unum and Ms. Weitzenkamp's employer. And there's all sorts of provisions in these policies. There's a 60% benefit. Well, why shouldn't it be 75% benefit? It's payable to age 65. Sometimes it's age 67. Sometimes it's lifetime.
But I feel that this is an exception that really could swallow the entire rule. And at the very least, it ought to be in your summary plan description, because I would say almost any disability is measured by the amount of pain and fatigue. For example, stage 4 cancer or almost anything. There are people who are not, the manifestations are such that they could work, and there are people where the manifestations are such that they can't work. So you're always measuring these symptoms of a disease, not the disease itself. So I don't understand why this exception doesn't swallow the rule, or if it doesn't, then why isn't fibromyalgia just one disease that could, you've got to figure out a way to objectively measure the manifestation.
Well, I believe you put your finger on the issue, Judge. I mean, and there's just lines being drawn on coverage and what level of coverage, and this is a line that this employer chose to draw for its employees in obtaining its benefit plan. It says what it says. And under this circuit's authority, based on that, so long as it's a reasonable interpretation of what it says, it's enforceable. And that's where I depart a little bit from the Welch opinion as well. And Chronister, the construction principles in those circuits are a little bit different. In this circuit, I think it was laid to rest in the Mars versus Motorola case, and it sort of reconciled some of these issues, but said if there's discretionary authority in this policy, there's no contra pro ferentum, and so long as the interpretation is one of several reasonable interpretations, the court isn't going to inject its interpretation or substitute its interpretation of the provision.
I don't know how detailed your negotiations were with Ms. Weitzenkamp's employer, but let's suppose those negotiations...
They're quite colorful, I'll say that.
Suppose they occurred in early 2007, after Chronister has been decided. You're discussing, the employer and the insurance company are discussing this clause, what it means. The employer gets some legal advice. The question arises, well, how does this apply to fibromyalgia, for example? And the lawyer does a little research and says, well, the Eighth Circuit has said fibromyalgia is not excluded by this as long as there are positive indications on the tender points test. So we ought to be able to expect that fibromyalgia would not be limited in this way, right?
Well, I guess I'd get out a map of how the circuits are drawn here And since the employer
is... There's no other decision dealing with that clause, right, at a circuit level?
At a circuit level, I would agree. There are a smattering of district court decisions. If I were the attorney perhaps involved in that hypothetical event, I'd probably say, yeah, you're right. But again, I get back to the reasoning of that decision and not focusing on the issue that we're talking about, which is the manifestation of fibromyalgia, not the diagnosis of it.
So your customer should be expected to predict that other circuits would disagree with the reasoning of the Eighth Circuit and conclude that fibromyalgia coverage is limited. Is that the position?
I think so, Judge. I mean, there are splits on a number of issues between the Seventh and Eighth Circuits on ERISA. The only other issue, unless the court, and I don't know how I'm doing on time.
You're doing great.
Okay. The only other issue I'd like to address briefly, unless the court has more questions, is the procedural, the purported procedural irregularities of Unum. This circuit has said that a procedural irregularity has to be very serious, bordering on misrepresentation, et cetera, to really affect the benefits decision. And I think that's applicable here, particularly with respect to the unfortunate disclosure of the medical information to the employer. No one has ever suggested that that was an intentional, it was an accident, and it was unfortunate. The sorts of and on the other issue on Dr. Bress, as pointed out in our brief, that again goes to the issue of diagnosis again and not whether there is objective evidence of the manifestation of pain.
Mr. Wagner, could I ask you about that privacy issue?
Yes.
If Ms. Weitzenkamp sued you all in Wisconsin State Court for invasion of privacy, would you remove and claim it's preempted under ERISA?
We would likely try, Your Honor.
So why shouldn't ERISA recognize a pretty severe response to that serious an invasion of a customer's privacy? If you're telling me that you would try to prevent any other legal remedy for it.
I think, Your Honor, I guess if you removed it, a couple of different parts there, I guess. How I would respond to that is that there really isn't any substantive remedy provided. There might be a substantive remedy under state law, and it may or may not be preempted under ERISA, and I understand the removal issue. As we would argue that as preempted.
Let's talk about preemption as a defense.
Yeah. I would look at it. I really couldn't hazard a guess. I guess the difficulty I have is I don't see what the substantive remedy is in an ERISA case. Maybe there's a state law remedy.
Court could recognize a breach of a contractually founded duty. You could call it tort. You could call it contract.
Yeah, and I guess it's my sense that perhaps it isn't preempted. I mean, it doesn't really relate to the employee welfare benefit plan directly. And getting back to perhaps your original question, I think this court and the circuits in general, none of them have found that sort of action connects directly to the merits of a benefit decision or altering the standard of review. Plaintiff's counsel hasn't found it. I didn't find anything one way or the other either. It seems to be so far removed from what we're talking about today, the application of this provision, that it shouldn't necessarily be applicable to it or considered. And unless, I guess, the court has any other questions.
Can I just check my notes for a second?
Certainly, Your Honor.
You have your organization. We have our organization. They rarely match up exactly. So.
We should compare notes beforehand next time.
I have a question.
Certainly.
Very quickly. Is it in the Social Security disability field, there's a concept of a combination of impairments.
Yes.
And that, it sounds like, in this case, everybody's focused on the one diagnosis, even though there are others in the record floating around.
That's true. I believe at the end of the day it's Dr. Partain who makes the diagnosis everyone is somewhat relying on, and he identifies fibromyalgia and then other psychological conditions which fall squarely within the mental condition limitation in the policy. So in some cases, that is a very complicated issue. What's the causative, what's causing the disability? And it is gets very complicated when you have physical conditions and fibromyalgia and other conditions, you have comorbidity. Here, it's not an issue in this case because regardless of the precise diagnosis, all are subject to, in Unum's view, the 24-month limitation.
Can I ask you one other question, Mr. Wagner? The final denial letter, August 22, 2008, says to Ms. Weitzenkamp, as indicated in our letter to you dated July 25, 2006, benefits were being paid to you under the self-reported and mental and nervous limitation provision. I looked at that July 25, 2006 letter and didn't see any such indication. It wasn't in the summary plan description. It wasn't in that letter. That's troubling.
Your Honor, I don't have it right. I'll concur with your observation on that. I can't recall off the top of my head whether there were other communications apart from that. Thank you very much.
How much time does Mr. Olson have? Give him a minute, please.
Unum argues that the policy says what it says, and that, I think, requires a response on the estoppel issue because it's not that simple. As we know, the SPD didn't have it, the language in it. The approval letter didn't discuss it. In fact, the approval letter not only was missing the definition, the approval letter affirmatively defined post-24-month disability as the standard Unum any occupation definition that we find in most Unum policies. No mention whatsoever of the self-reported limitation. Also, because there is ambiguity and the clause is poorly written, the district court in this case should have construed that in favor of Weitzenkamp as a non-drafting party. And that can be done certainly under a de novo standard. Finally, there was the Social Security disability decision that Unum, under its regulatory settlement agreement, pursuant to which it was fined $15 million, it had agreed that it would look carefully at Social Security disability awards, decisions, and also in MetLife versus Glenn, the court addressed that when there's a conflict of interest, like there is in this case, that's at least one factor that should be considered. Thank you.
Well, thanks to both counsel for another very well-argued case.